Had I not been alert, we would have had a mid-air collision right then and there, because he would have come down right on top of me. As it was, I saw what was happening in time enough to go into a dive myself, and we missed. But when we got back to 30 Mile and landed, Taylor was quite shaken by this and said, "God, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that I'd confused you, and I didn't mean for you to change sides at all." And he apologized profusely, which really wasn't necessary. But it all's well that ends well, I suppose. On the 24th of December, Sid lent me an airplane to go down to Port Moresby to 12 Mile Airstrip and visit Don Raines. That's where they set alerts. They lived around there. And I flew down that day and spent the afternoon talking to Raines and the other guys that I knew. And late in the afternoon, I returned back to 30 Mile. Now, the reason for what then happened, I never quite understood, because I was not aware at the time that anything was wrong, or even unusual. But the fact of the matter must have been that I probably landed too high or something, though I wasn't conscious of that. Nevertheless, when I landed, the left-hand landing gear broke off, and the airplane went over onto the left wing, and of course the right landing gear was still down, and the airplane ran off the runway, such as it was, out across the fields, and then the left wing dug into the ground and the whole thing came right up. I thought it was going to turn upside down. Fortunately, it didn't. It got way up, right wing way up in the air, and lost its momentum and fell back down, and everything came to a stop. And I jumped out and ran out on the wing, didn't know what to do, but this accident had been observed by ground crews who came tearing out in several jeeps and asked me if I was all right, which I was, though I was chagrined and embarrassed. Anyway, that was my first aircraft accident since I'd learned to fly. I was lucky, because, as it turned out, nobody much cared, because during my absence, it had been announced that one squadron in each of the three fighter groups in New Guinea was going to be re-equipped with P-38s. And as for the 49th Fighter Group, it was the 9th Squadron, which had been picked to get P-38s at the end of the month, and it was already close to the end of the month. So, instead of getting bawled out for the stupid accident, as soon as the CO found out that I wasn't hurt, he had nothing more to say. In fact, he was very nice to me, as a matter of fact, about this thing. Well, of course, the P-38 business was great news, but there was even better news than that, in a sense, and that was that 5th Fighter Command had apparently come to the conclusion that it was inhuman to keep people up there at 30 Mile with all those mosquitoes, and we were going to be moved out and moved down to Port Moresby with everybody else, and that was certainly a boon. They had mosquitoes in Port Moresby too, of course, but nothing like they were up at 30 Mile. Well, then there was some bad news along with all this too. It seems that when the P-38s had been sent over to New Guinea, Australia's where they were at the moment, the U.S. had also sent along a number of pilots with them, pilots who had flying experience with P-38s, and they had to be accommodated somewhere. That meant, of course, that the 9th Squadron was going to end up with too many pilots, so they had to get rid of some, and they did the logical thing. They distributed the extras, of whom I was one. That's naturally all the most junior pilots were the ones who were put out. And we were redistributed between the 7th Squadron and the 8th Squadron, who were to keep their P-40s. Well, I was bitterly disappointed in that, but that's the way it was. In the meantime, for the next few days, we continued flying missions out of 17 Mile. And we had not yet moved. On Sunday, December the 27th, we were sent on a patrol over to Buna, as usual. I was, on that day, flying on the wing of Clay Tice. And while we were patrolling over there, we were suddenly notified over the air that the Japanese were coming down. And so, of course, we started to climb as fast as we could to get as much altitude as possible before we were attacked. Whoever has the most altitude is at a distinct advantage. So Tice began to climb like mad, and I climbed along with him. We got up to 21,000 some feet, I suppose. And all I was doing was hanging in there on Tice's wing the way I was supposed to do. And this event is notable for several reasons, but the main one was it was the first time in the history of World War II that the P-38 had taken on a Zero in combat. Now, this meant a great deal to the people who were there at the time, and I'll tell you why. Because up to that time, the Japanese Zeros could outdo most everything that we could do. And people held them in a good deal of awe. And one of the main things was that the Zeros always could get higher than we could, and there was nothing you could do about that. And they could climb faster and turn tighter and things like that. So it was a big day when we got P-38s in New Guinea, because the P-38s could go higher than Zeros and could go faster and climb just about as well, though they couldn't turn as tightly. Anyway, the P-38s got into their first combat with Zeros on December the 27th, 1942. I don't know what squadron that was. Of course, it wasn't our squadron. We hadn't, the 9th Squadron hadn't gotten P-38s yet. So it was one of the other two squadrons that had been re-equipped. Anyway, they were over there patrolling at the same time, and the first thing I knew, all hell sort of broke loose, and of course I couldn't see all that well, but I was trying to stick there on Tice's wing, but I do remember on one occasion seeing two P-38s and one Zero all in a loop. There was a P-38 and a Zero behind him and a P-38 behind him, and all of them were just going around and around in a continuous loop. And then the trouble began. difficulty which persisted for a long, long time. It persisted as long as I was in New Guinea. And that was the fact that the P-38s, which were easily distinguishable because they had twin tail booms, got it into their heads that any airplane that didn't have two tail booms was Japanese and should be shot down. So, on this occasion, like many another that was to follow, the P-38s shot as much at P-40s as they did at Zeros. And I wasn't aware of this suddenly, and I heard Tice hollering over the air, and he said, P-38, P-38, you mind who you're shooting at? You hear me? And I looked around over my shoulder, and there was this P-38 drawing a bead on us. And he would have hit us, too, except that Tice peeled off to the right and went into a cloud, and I peeled off to the left and went into another cloud. And after a while, I heard Tice say, come on out, Dilworth, and it's okay. So I came out, and I saw him and joined him, and we went home because we were low on gas by this time. Well, one of our people who was with us, a boy named Newman, also in a P-40, and when he got back, he had been shot all to hell by a P-38, and it was incredible he hadn't been killed. He had a bullet hole in his left wing just beside the cockpit, a cannon hole in the vertical stabilizer, another cannon shell in the belly, and a big piece shot out of the rear of his canopy, two bullet holes in his propeller. And at first, everybody thought Zero had done this. But when they started examining the hole, somebody said, I don't think there was a Zero at all. I think this is a P-38. This is 50 caliber stuff. And so it was. And the P-38s admitted that they had done this thing by mistake. They shot at several P-40s, almost including mine. There was an amusing comment in some book written a few years ago about the 5th Air Force in New Guinea in World War II, and they described this battle on this day because it was the first P-38 battle with the Zeros, and the P-38 shot down a number of Zeros, but the author of the book said, but with the sweet there also came the bitter, because it was later discovered that the P-38s had shot holes in several P-40s, as indeed they had. Well, it was all very exciting. Round about the 29th or 30th of December, I, along with Snuffy Smith and Duncan Myers and a few others, were transferred to the 7th Squadron. The 7th Squadron, I didn't know any of those people at the time. I hardly did. But they were had a camp about a mile or two from a 17-mile strip, camp on a hillside amongst some trees, not very closely spaced trees, but they were trees. The hillside was quite steep. And we had a mess hut, a thatched hut up on the hillside, and that's where we ate and where we hung out. There were no screens or anything, and so it was open to the mosquitoes and so forth, but the mosquitoes weren't all that bad over there. And Snuffy Smith and I had a tent of our own. We set up a tent on the hillside and lived there for quite a long time. And I was assigned to a flight with a man named Hilliard. Very nice fella, very low-key and rather quiet. Good man. The squadron commander was a man named Captain Manning, lot of people called him Red because he had red hair. He was a good man. Somebody once told me later that a squadron commander should be able to outfly, outfight, and outfuck any man in his squadron. But Manning was the only CO I ever had who fit that description. He could have done all three of those things anytime. He also had a hot temper and would fly into rages sometimes at the drop of a hat and bawl people out immoderately. Nevertheless, he was a damn good man. There was never any question as to who was running the show when he was CO of the 7th Squadron. One day I paid a visit to the 9th Squadron. The 9th was over at some other strip at this time. I don't know just where. 14 mile, maybe. But they had their P-38s, and when I went out to look at one of those things up close, this was the first time I'd really seen a P-38 close, I ran into one of the old crew chiefs that I had known, and he, I remember, took me out and let me get, he said, "Do you want to start the engines?" And of course I did. So I got in the damn cockpit, and he showed me what to do, and I started both engines and all, and that was a big thrill. I remember that to this day. As a matter of fact, most of the men in the 9th Squadron that I knew had not even been checked out in the P-38s yet, though they did have new men in the squadron who had a good deal of experience with that airplane. One day, early in January 1943, we went over for the usual patrol over Buna. Things were getting very hot over at Buna by this time. The U.S. and Australian troops had just about gotten the Japanese out of there. And on this day, January 2nd, we went over there to patrol, and we weren't very high, and it became apparent that at this stage the Americans and the Australians were shelling the Japanese, and the Japanese had nowhere to go, and so they had run out into the ocean and waded out in the water. A lot of them, they were just standing out there in the water. They didn't have anywhere else to go, and the jungle was partly on fire by now. So we were instructed to go down there and strafe these poor devils out there in the water, and they were totally without protection. So we went and did that, but unhappily, I couldn't get my guns to fire. Second place, my radio didn't work either. And I could see Hilliard making motions for me to strafe these troops, but I couldn't. The guns absolutely wouldn't fire. And eventually we went home, and I don't know what they found out about the guns, why they wouldn't fire, but they wouldn't. And it was fixed, but I was pissed about the whole affair. I remember that. You probably remember old Joe Hensler, who had gone over to Bombers, and he was in the 43rd Bomb Group, which had a few good B-17s. And old Charlie Smith was also in one of those squadrons. I don't know which squadron is entirely made up, the 43rd Bomb Group. They had the 63rd Squadron and the 64th and one other, but I don't know what the one other was. But anyway, we got in the Jeep, some of us, Don Raines and a couple of us, others, and drove over there to the 43rd Group, and found old Joe and found old Charlie Smith, and spent all afternoon and talking to them. We had supper with them and spent a good part of the evening, and then eventually we drove back home. First time we had seen those guys since we left Williamtown. In every outfit, no matter what, and all of this was true of the 7th Fighter Squadron, somebody is appointed every day to be OD, which stands for Officer of the Day. Hard to tell what the OD is supposed to do. I don't think anybody had a very clear idea, but in general, he's sort of in charge of what goes on that day, which doesn't mean that he's the squadron commander. He's not, but he's the one people go to or come to if there are problems and decisions have to be made. And you're on duty of 24 hours at a time when you have this duty. And on this particular day, I was the OD. Now, as I said, our camp was a mile or two up the road from the airstrip. And the practice, what we had places cut out in the jungle on either side of the runway for park the airplanes so they wouldn't be exposed, just the same way we had done up at 30 Mile, only better. But here we had guards on the airplanes every night. We used to have one guard on the airplane, each airplane, all night. Well, the guys hated it because of the mosquitoes, but they were also frightened. And I don't think they were frightened of the Japanese. I think they were frightened of wildlife. And some of them said that huge snakes had come up and threatened them. And don't think anybody believed that much. But anyway, permission had been given at some time in the past for them to do away with these individual guards on each airplane, and they had instead something called a roving guard, which meant that they had four or five men in a pickup truck, and they just drove around all night back and up and down the strip, looking out for the airplanes and so forth, but at least they weren't quite so exposed to mosquitoes or to these terrible snakes, which were said to infest the area. Anyway, it was a practice for the officer of the day at some time at night before he went to bed, generally about 11 o'clock or something. You had a jeep assigned to you, and you'd drive down to the strip. And what I always did, I'd drive down, say, the right-hand side of the strip, and every time I came to one of the gaps in the woods where the airplane was parked, I'd turn the jeep lights in so they shone on the airplane, and I could see it every looked all right, and nobody seemed to be messing with it. And you'd do this all the way down one side of the runway, across the end, and back up the other side. And that's what I was doing on this occasion. Well, there was a wide area on both sides of the runway itself. Very wide area, and I was driving along this shoulder, so to speak, and I thought a tree limb in the way, and so I stopped and was looking at this thing, thinking I'd have to get out and move it, and then I realized that I was actually looking at a python stretched out full length right across my path. He wasn't doing anything, just lying there. Well, I was sitting there in the jeep looking at this great snake, the biggest thing I'd ever seen in the way of a snake outside of the zoo. And at that moment, the roving guard drove up beside me in their pickup truck. Well, we sat there talking for a minute, and it became apparent to me that the guards did not see this python at all. And I said to one of them who was leaning out the window, how about that? And he said, how about what? And I said, how about that? And I pointed at the snake, and he looked and suddenly realized what it was. And he said, oh, and darted back inside the truck and rolled up the window. Well, we sat there for another minute or something, and they got bold and rolled down the windows, and then one of the guard people in the guard said, Lieutenant, he said, why don't you get out and shoot it? And I said, no, he said, why don't you drive over it? And I said, hell, man, I'm not driving over that snake in this Jeep. It was an open-top Jeep, had no top on it, anything, nothing to keep, anything to keep the snake from getting in there with me if he chose. I said, you got a cab there, you roll up the windows and you drive over it. Well, they did. They just drove right over that python. He didn't pay a bit of attention to this, not the least. Oh, I suppose he moved a little, but not much. He just lay there. I think he was blinded by the lights, for one thing, and confused. But he didn't do anything. So we sat around wondering what to do next, and I went over to the alert hut where there was a phone and called up the camp. The mess hall where the other guys were, the pilots, and I told them, asked them if they wanted to come down and see it. Well, of course they did. Well, they came piling down there, a jeep load of guys. I bet there were six or eight of them in that one jeep. Well, one of them, a guy named Steer, and he was drunk as a hoot owl. What he got drunk off of, I'll never know, because I never saw much liquor around. But anyway, he was drunk. And he decided that he was going to shoot this python, which was stupid, but it didn't seem so at the time. At least I don't remember objecting to any of this. So he borrowed a rifle from one of the guard and did indeed shoot this poor snake through the head and killed it. And somehow they managed to pile this great thing, which was about 16 feet long, as it later measured, on the hood of the Jeep, and old Steer, drunk as he could be, sat on the snake, and they disappeared into the darkness. I remember Steer screaming, snake, 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 as they disappeared down the road and went back to camp. They took the snake and put it in the kitchen or something to scare the cooks the next morning, but as it turned out, the cooks didn't see it until long after it was daylight and long after they were candidates for being frightened in this manner. One day I remember a B-25, one of the ones that was flying off the 17-mile strip, same as we were, caught fire while refueling and blew up. Of course, we didn't know anything about it till we heard this terrible explosion and then ran out and saw this, what was left of it, which was practically nothing, burning away down at the far end of the runway. But it had some bombs on it, and apparently they exploded too, or one of them did, or some of them did, but there wasn't much left of that airplane, I can tell you that. Whether or not anyone was injured, I don't know, but I don't really see how it could have been otherwise. One of the places we used to go to escort sometimes bombers, but more often transports, which means C-47s, was an old gold mining town by the name of Wau, W-A-U. Now, Wau was located between two mountain ridges. A stream flowed down along the extreme edge of one of the ridges and right at the bottom of the other. And on the south side of the stream, there was sort of a abbreviated, what I'll call an alluvial plain, which sloped down to the river. And the only way airplanes could get in there was to fly down the river or up the river and then make a quick 90-degree left turn and land right uphill on this short little strip right into the mountainside towards the south. It always looked impossible to me, but those transports used to do it daily, and I don't know that many of them came to grief. I don't altogether know either what the Japanese were doing over there, because this was quite far inland. But there they were, and they had to be rooted out somehow. Wow is a place I've always wanted to go, meaning to be go on the ground, and perhaps someday I shall do so. I've never seen it except from the air, however. Occasionally we would have to escort B-26s, and that means not the airplane that was later designated the B-26. I'm talking about the Martin B-26, a twin-engine bomber. We always hated to do that because they were so fast. They were faster than we were, and we had a good deal of trouble keeping up with them, let alone trying to give them any protection. But they had some of them over there, and we had to do that from time to time. It was always a contest to see who could keep up with whom.